On Saturday, March 15th, 2025, Dr. Khune Lance Twitchell won an Emmy Award. The following day, he was welcomed home at the Juneau Airport with song and some words.
Thank you very much, and welcome home.
Wish it talk a ya haani.
Oh, what?
Ya ye dat kua. Suke what talk a ya haani, ya hatraki. Ye kusakani tina ya. Ya at kagatus is a ya to cut up for sea ye kaha you katung.
Yeah,
oh, what? A talk a skirtnik ye away. Hatu ye has our tea. Ya should seem. Ya hashish go has a ya. Hajat khatki sani hasa khsa khu ya ha khusi yi kha has ka shniki acha we khushi ya khwa sa tushke ataya has tu jide ga tu ti ya khatun tsini at has tu ya ak kedena we adag ha ya sa ta khya yi dat arshin kun chi shu han ya tek kedena khwa sa ya yi dat I'm out of breath, so you get the I am so thankful for this opportunity to stand on the backs of all the storytellers who brought us here, all the people who work on this wonderful show. It takes so many hands to do something like this. Hurting people is such an easy thing to do these days, but it's not the way for us to live and to survive and to really know one another. So I think of Kahwanish George Davis, who said, "Do not do things with ill will, do not say things with ill will to the people of the world who are like you. Just put love and kindness in your heart."
The following Juneau Afternoon Rainy Day Conversation was first aired the day before on Friday, March 14th on KTOO. Gunath Cheesh for listening. You are listening to community-supported Juneau Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juneau, 91.7 Juneau Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. Today, it's our rainy day conversation with community leader, UAS professor, author, and language revitalization expert, and now Emmy-nominated screenwriter, Dr. Khune Lance Twitchell. I'm honored to welcome Dr. Twitchell to Studio 2K here at KTOO. Gunath Cheesh, Ha'i Gudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Was Iati, how's it going?
Es was a chatuti, ya achtu ya ke, ya ke chatuti, ya haskasni ki datoe yi tukhwetang ya ya ki, ya cha adusa owe ach in, hasa kaukhlani kwe shingitskasni ki tachwasa shtuqa chatuti hasu ide. I'm happy to be here. It's a great day. Today I was thinking of storytellers, like especially in the Tlingit language, and everyone who has ever told me a story or some of the elders sometimes who would say, tell me a story in Tlingit. That's a really fun sort of moment as a language learner, is when your teachers start asking you to talk to them, just because they want to, they would love to interact with people. And so, cheese for having me here.
Most of the time, I introduce the guests with bio and information, but in the Tlingit and indigenous cultures, it's more likely it's the person that does it themselves. Would you share your Tlingit introduction with us and what's included in that and why it's important?
My name is Rene. I'm Lukach Adi Tlingit. I'm Kigani Haida. I'm Yupik and I'm Sami. I'm a child of the Kagwantan. I am a grandchild of the Duklawedi. I was born in Skagway. We call ourselves Lkut Kwan. We're the people of Lkut. And I'm very fortunate to live on the lands of the Akkwan peoples and to teach the Tlingit language here. My goal is always to teach with love and kindness, and I know sometimes introductions could take a long time. I always threaten to write a play called 10 People Introduce Themselves, or 10 Tlingit People Introduce Themselves, a play in 5 acts. So, yeah.
And it's important that in the introduction, most times people are including where they're from, sometimes who their parents are, and why is that?
Well, yeah, so you, from a perspective of what we call like Tlingit Tundatani, so the Tlingit way of thinking, you are yourself, but you're also the people who held the name before you. So there was another Rene, his name was Fenton Jacobs, and if Fenton Jacobs had a nephew, so there was a nephew of his named Charles DeWitt, and when I met him and he heard my Tlingit name, he called me his paternal uncle. And he's probably 85 years old. And he's like, "Wasawayak, Sonny." So he's like, "What's up, my uncle?" You know, and so the way that kinship works in Tlingit is very interesting to me, because you hold on to these relationships. So historically, someone who was a raven would marry someone who was an eagle, and they would have children, and they always follow the mother's line. So as a father, your children are your opposites. Like, this is how it used to be, right? And so a lot of times when I would be talking, I would be talking to them, and I would be singing songs to them, and I would be giving love to them and giving them gifts and feeding them. And then they would do the same for me. It was a very reciprocal type of thing. And so you have situations where if I meet someone and they say, "I'm Duklawedi clan," my thought is, so is my grandfather, so you are my grandparent. Even if they're, you know, a student of mine, I will call them Achlilko. And so, and I've had friends who's, you know, and as we talked about later, she's like, "I was trying to figure out why you're calling me granny," because, you know, I'm not that old, but it's about like the kinship structure. And so thinking of those things. And then also, like, if it's so strong. So there's this elder I worked with a lot. Her name was Shkate, Jessie Johnny. And when she first met my firstborn child, she said, "Does she have a Tlingit name?" I said, "Well, I've given her a nickname. I call her Kasechja." And then she said, "Well, I want her to have my Tlingit name. I was given these two Duklawedi names because I brought their atu to a funeral. And I really helped them out, and they gave me these two names. And so this name is Qarqis. It's a killer whale in front of the pod, and it looks like it's going up and down like a person sewing." And I said, "Wow, that's beautiful. Okay, I'll talk to the Declarated people and see if they'll do that. And then she called me about a week later. I think I was walking like right down past the Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater. And my phone rang and it was her, so I picked it up. And she said, "Hi, Dad." I was like, "Oh, sheesh." So because she had given one of her names to my daughter, she was now going to call me her father. Mm. And this is an elder who's, she was probably in her late 80s, and she said, "I never got to know my dad very well, and I've always wanted to have a dad, so I'm really excited." You know, and then that was one of the last conversations I ever had with her. Like, she passed away not long after that. But just thinking of how strong those kinship terms are, which is, that's the reason why we usually do these long introductions, because someone's there and they might listen and be like, "Oh, wow, that's my daughter now. Oh, that's my father's people." And so then you're going to choose a kinship term, and that might end up be what you call that person for the rest of your life instead of their name. Like, you'll usually use that kinship term when you call out to them and talk to them.
We'll take a short break. I'm speaking with Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, Emmy-nominated writer for Molly of Denali, language revitalization expert, and poetry writer. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from KTOO. Let's continue our rainy day conversation with Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, UAS professor, Emmy-nominated writer for Molly of Denali, language revitalization expert, and poet. All right, I want to talk about writing. You are nominated, Emmy nomination, for an episode of Molly of Denali called Not a Mascot. It is part of the Children and Family Emmy Awards that will be happening March 15th, 2025. Can you tell us a little bit about that specific episode that you wrote?
Yeah, I was really excited to write that episode. There's a few of us, especially there's four writers of Molly of Denali who live here in Juneau. And so the four of us sometimes are on these text threads or talk, just chatting with each other about projects we're working on and how it's going. And writing for PBS is such a wonderful thing, but it's also, it's quite the experience because you sort of go through these, it's different every time, but here's an example of how it sometimes works is they'll say, "Okay, pitch us 10 ideas. And so you write basically in two or three sentences your whole episode. So you have to give like a summary of what your whole episode would be. And these episodes are, they're only 11 minutes long and they're written for pretty young audience, and so you sort of, you have these constraints, and so you have to sort of fit within those things. And then they usually want there to be some sort of central problem, and then a character resolves the problem. And so you'll pitch these 10 ideas, and then they'll say, "Okay, we'll take these two. Why don't you go forward?" And so then you sort of write a little bit of a longer description of what that story is going to be, and then you start writing out all the particular scenes of what that story is going to be. And this whole time, you're sending it into one person who's showing it to about six other people, and then they're all giving you feedback, and the feedback gets a little bit more specific and intense the farther you go in the process. And everybody has a different colored text on there so that you can tell, like, this is the feedback from this person, from this person, from that person, and there's a head writer of the show. So it's, screenwriting is a very collaborative effort in that way. Like, I'm sure there are some people who write just whole films and they maybe do it themselves. But when you're writing for something that's an episode, you have to carry like these characters through this whole like little tiny narrative arc. And so when I was presented with this idea, and so I'd written 3 episodes before this. So there's one called The Funny Face Competition, which was my first one, which I think kind of made fun of the idea of Native people don't smile in pictures and older photographers who sort of came here and maybe asked people not to smile. And so it kind of pokes fun at that a little bit. And then they have a funny face competition, which was so much fun. And then there's an episode called Nature's Medicine that's talking about if you're out in the woods, there's all this medicine around you and you can learn how to use it. And then the third one was Raven Saves the Birthday Party, which came about because initially, like, I was asked to write a raven story. And so I had thought about this adoption of a raven story, but we tell our kids much different stories than PBS might tell our kids. And so ravens bonking people on the head and just causing a little bit of a ruckus. And I think we had to rethink everything. And so we ended up landing on the central part of that story, though, is this elder who tells stories, and then he watches this little boy becoming a storyteller. And like it turned out to be so fun. I was disappointed in how they reacted to my adaptation of a raven story, but you can't have raven killing other animals on PBS shows. And so I was like, okay, I get it now. I get it. But with the mascot issue, like, I wanted to be so careful with this episode because I understand people have, like, they will wear the hoodies of their schools for their entire life, and they will really be firmly associated with this stuff. And sometimes it's very complicated to have, like, indigenous mascots. But I think the stereotyping and the cartooning of culture that tends to happen with sports and Native Americans as mascots is very complicated. And especially if you're sort of, we get into these very weird conversations where people will sometimes, and I'll be in sometimes online conversations about this. And it gets very odd when you see some of these high schools and they're, you have the chiefs and the chiefettes and they're doing these very elaborate dances. And if you want to see something strange, which I don't recommend, but you could look at the last dance of the mascot for Illinois University when they retired him. There's like some, it's just very, like, you can psychoanalyze that if you want to. There's a lot of very complicated things going on in there in terms of identity and authenticity. But so I wanted to make sure that there was room in the episode for, you know, in an 11-minute episode aimed at children to say, like, nobody, we're not trying to embarrass anybody or make them ashamed, but we want to, what if the children had a genuine reaction to sort of like a team that's named the War Chiefs, you know, and just say, like, well, why? Like, why does that person look so angry? And why is this, you know, these things that doesn't represent us? And sometimes it falls into this generic sort of Native American identity as well. And to just sort of have them engage in a conversation of what would it be like to change the name. And hopefully to model some conversations that could happen. So you could listen to people and say, I do hear that you're very attached to that and you have your memories and no one's taking your memories from you. Nobody's preventing that from happening. But what if it was something else? And so it was a lot of fun to write. I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I also, like, there's so many locations where Molly can take place. We have these set sort of locations. That's kind of a behind-the-scenes look at sometimes when you're making animated things, is it costs a lot of money to make a whole new village, to take the whole thing to another community. And so sometimes the reality is we have to have those discussions where it's hard to do a whole episode about another community because you got to draw all those things over. And so as we sort of looked at it, it ended up being housed in Sitka. And I know a lot of people who've gone to Mount Edgecombe High School, and I wasn't picking on Mount Edgecombe High School, but I know that they're also in these conversations right now about a potential name change. And while we were having our language immersion there, I saw a mascot, I guess, that was painted onto a door, and it was literally like the Washington's football team's former logo, you know, and then it made me think of that name and just all these complications about why have these sports teams that are just named these things. And so, like, and I know I have relatives who love these sports teams, and I, you know, I'm a sports fan. I love to watch sports, but I do not like when they start singing those chants and doing their tomahawk chop. I think those things are just inauthentic and silly and offensive, but that's just my perspective. But then I wanted to be able to have an episode that, that could talk about that so that our children can engage in those conversations and they could witness adults and children having those conversations in ways that aren't threatening or that aren't violent conversations, but are people listening to each other and talking about, well, what else could it be and what does that mean?
It's a wonderful episode, and you were nominated for an Emmy. And like you said, there are multiple people, not just in Juneau, who are writers, but there's people involved all over the state who are writers and creatives and behind-the-scenes folks on this show. What has that been like as the opportunity to get Alaskan Natives involved in this particular show?
Yeah, it's been really exciting over the past 10 years to watch more Native American content emerging on television, film and television, especially stuff that is written by Native peoples. And so one of the things, when Molly of Denali was first being put together and was being produced, it involved a lot of conversations with Indigenous peoples across Alaska, talking to elders, to Alaska Native language speakers and knowledge bearers, and really trying to think of how to create this story. And yeah, a fictional village, but it's got to look like an Alaskan village. And some of these conversations, if you're talking about a national television show, like, we've had complicated conversations about, you know, should we have pilot bread in there? And the Alaskans were all gasp, ah, how could you not? And then everyone else would be like, nobody knows what pilot bread is. And so, I mean, like, there's little pockets of people who certainly do. And so we've had those conversations. But one of the things that's been just so wonderful is this Alaska Native Writers Mentorship Program that they also started. And so their commitment was, we want to make sure that there are Native people who are writing episodes, not every single episode, but their goal was to have more every year. And so being part of that mentorship sort of program, they would say, okay, you are going to write 4 episodes, you know. And it, for someone who had never written a television episode before, at least especially something that got made into like a real thing, that seemed so almost impossible. But then they just really helped you through the process and talked about the screenwriting software and that's the screenwriting process, and then going through a bunch of workshops with people who do that for a living. There's people who are writing on Curious George and Arthur and these other big shows who are talking to us about their process and who are open and who are sharing. And again, like, some of my images of what it's like to sort of write for film and television, sometimes I get real nervous that it's a don't steal my idea and it's a very like competitive sort of thing. But this environment was always collaborative and it was fun. And sometimes they would talk about some pretty big ideas in episodes and would have to have some difficult conversations and say, that's very sensitive and you need a co-writer at least who's Alaska Native. You can't tell that story if you're not us. And I know some of the episodes have been so impactful. So they address boarding schools, they address racism and whether people should look or not look like a Native person. And it's been really fun to see how those things are handled. And going back about a little over 2 years ago, when Molly of Denali got its first Emmy nomination, there was about 8 or 10 of us that went down there. And there are these Native people just walking through Hollywood and going to this very fancy awards ceremony. And we're sitting there with movie stars that we know. And it was so fascinating to me to think, what I thought about was all these Native people today, and especially the young people, and just that I could turn to young people and say, if you want to write for film and television, if you want to be a novelist, you want to be a poet, that's absolutely something you can do. Because when I was in high school and I thought of these ideas, like, I had a guidance counselor who didn't provide very good guidance. And when I said the things that I wanted to do, that person would tell me, that's too hard. That's too complicated. You should do something easier. Instead of sort of acknowledging and saying, okay, let's figure out how you could do that. So when it came out, I was teaching in Sitka. We were teaching classes at Mount Edgecombe through a developing two-year program called Outer Coast. And it might have been the second year we had Outer Coast, because I know Saul Neely was there. And I knew that the series was going to premiere, and they were going to drop, I think, 10 or so episodes. And so it had never been seen. There had never been a children's television show that featured a Native lead character, and especially a Native girl. It was so amazing. And my kids were probably the age of Molly of Denali at that time. And I remember just how emotional it was for me, because I was able to tell my daughter in front of a room full of people that when I grew up, the Native Americans, I watched Bugs Bunny murder Native American people and sing a song about it. And all the Native American characters were either buffoons or were just silent partners, like in the Justice League. I think they had a Native American character who maybe said like five things through the entirety of that show. And so it was such an amazing thing. And we had Native kids that were in this Outer Coast program. And this one young man, he stopped coming to class. And so we went to have a meeting with him. And we said, hey, you got to come to class. We need you to come to class. And he said, well, Molly of Denali came out and I watched every single episode. Mm. And I was like, okay, I'll just cry and just be happy that this exists, because to just like never see yourself in something and then to be part of it and to say, my kids won't know what it's like to not be part of that thing. And so it's just fun and exciting.
Hollywood doesn't have the best history of representation, not just for Indigenous peoples, but for peoples of all kinds. What is it like to be working as an Indigenous creative in that space right now?
Yeah, well, I just want to give a lot of love to the folks that are on that team, like especially Vera Starbird and Frank Katas and Joe Yates. Like that's the other three that live here. And so sometimes we just collaborate with each other about like, how do we keep doing this? Because watching Vera take off and become a lead writer on Alaska Daily and just seeing Alaska Daily, which is at its core bringing attention to missing and murdered Indigenous women, and just to think that being part of a nationally televised series is exciting. It's a primetime series. And then at the same time, Rutherford Falls was coming out and Reservation Dogs was coming out. And then to see like more Native American content coming out, we realized like we're not that far from these other writers who are creating this content. And so for us, there's often conversations about how to be our authentic selves, how to not cross boundaries, because sometimes we don't want to tell stories that aren't ours to tell. We don't want to be tokenized. We don't want to be exploited. But we also want that content to be there. And so it's really exciting to see all this stuff happening at the same time, because you can get ideas from one another and you can really support each other and you could take off into these sort of whole other realms that didn't seem like it's maybe not even something you thought of before, like writing an opera in Tlingit and talking to Vera about that process. And then watching Frank taking plays to the Autry and down in Los Angeles and just seeing these people who are creating incredible content, telling amazing stories, and just saying, yeah, I remember I was in a workshop one time with an Indigenous author that I don't want to name because I think he ruined it for himself, but he was making a joke, but I also felt like it was one of those things where like it's a joke, but maybe not a joke. And he said, well, we're doing this Native writers workshop, but I kind of don't want to help you guys because there can only be one famous Native writer at a time. And I remember I was so disappointed to hear it. I thought it was kind of funny. But then I thought, well, look at it now. Now there's going to be Tommy Orange, and there's Don Reardon, and there's so much stuff, and there's Louise Erdrich, and there's so many folks that can just sort of like keep pushing these things. And it's almost like we're coming into this space that's decidedly not for us. Like, you know, I think of Hollywood and you think of like maybe Marlon Brando and the, I can't remember her name now, the Native American woman who he had like sort of accept an award on behalf as part of a protest of how Native people were sort of being treated in America generally. And just like to have Native voices, I think another story I heard was Chief Dan George like didn't win an Academy Award because some people thought, well, he's a Native person playing a Native person. Like what? That's not really acting.
Mm.
You know, and who knows who was saying these things, but you wouldn't say that necessarily about like this white guy in Boston. He's just playing a white guy from Los Angeles. That's not acting, right? And so, but just to see like it's all in, because he, you know, he wasn't from the area that he was playing, that, you know, he wasn't a Cherokee person. And so he was playing a whole different, like, anyways. But to see like the limits being removed more and more with like Lily Gladstone emerging and her performance and what she did going from Reservation Dogs to Killers of the Flower Moon, and to see like it's so wonderful. And what it feels like is we're stepping into a room that's very crowded and very pushy, but we're pushing things out and creating a space so that other people could come in after us, and that it doesn't have to be so easy, and they don't have to be trendsetters, and they don't have to forge a path on how a Native person could do this, because one way to do it has been lit up for them.
We'll take a short break. I'm speaking with Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, Emmy-nominated writer for Molly of Denali, language revitalization expert, and poetry writer.
Support from Hanson Gress, seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from KTOO. Let's continue our rainy day conversation with Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, UAS professor, Emmy-nominated writer for Molly of Denali, language revitalization expert, and poet. We hear this term a lot, decolonize. What does decolonization mean, and how can we all participate in that process?
Yeah, well, I guess the difficult part for me is like, so I teach the Tlingit language, and I also teach indigenous studies. And the Tlingit language requires decolonization in order to even just survive. And so when we talk about decolonization, I really like the phrase, like, it's not a metaphor, it's a reality. And land back is not a metaphor, it's a reality. But then we have to sort of let people know, well, what does it mean? What does it mean? And so I think a lot of Shikshani March Detson, who went to a school that was called, I think, Mayflowers, the Mayflower School, and it's over in Douglas, and it's totally not what it used to be. But on her first day of school, her older sibling tried to warn her not to speak Tlingit, but that's the language she knew, and she was just speaking Tlingit, and a teacher called her up in front of the class and picked her up by her hair, shook her violently, and threatened to hit her in the face if she spoke the language again, and then just dropped her. And like the violence, the fear, the embarrassment of having that happen to you. And so her hair is all pulled out, she's in pain, she's crying, she's scared, and she gathers her things and walks home, and then watches her parents get into a fight because her dad wanted to go kill that teacher for hurting his baby. And so to think of like, to get us where we are today, where the Tlingit language exists in hardly any single space, has taken a tremendous amount of violence, like physical violence, social violence, emotional violence, spiritual violence. And that now it's just been normalized that Tlingit is not expected to be in a place. Like, I can't go order a coffee in Tlingit. I can't just order food. I can't just, you know, communicate and tell people how to pay for something in Tlingit, and on and on and on. But one of the things that happens is this way of life is sort of normalized. The death of indigenous languages is normalized. And so what decolonization asks us to do is to say, what if we had multiple focus points on how to do things and think of things? What if we also included the Tlingit language in education? What if we included the Tlingit language in day-to-day communication to a point where, like, what if we explored this possibility of being a truly multilingual place? Because what we're seeing now is we're getting more and more monolingual to the point where, like, schools will probably lose all of their funding for teaching something other than English. Like, those are conversations that are going on right now. And I have people who are telling me to not use the word decolonization in my work and to not use the word diversity or equity or inclusion, because these are trigger words and they're going to come and cut all the funding from you because you use these words. But for me, I think of, well, what's the opposite of these words? So the opposite of decolonization for me is the death of the indigenous peoples and their way of living and being and thinking and speaking. The opposite of diversity is homogeny, like everybody has to assimilate and be white. The opposite of equity is inequity, is have like vastly unequal situations. And then the opposite of inclusion is exclusion. And for an indigenous person, it just feels like somebody burned down our village, built a beautiful school, and now we're saying, oh, we'd love to come in and be in that school as well. And they'll say, oh, that'd be great, but all the rooms are taken. Everybody has a space except for you. And we've been like kept out of those spaces. And so it requires us to think of, what if it's something else? Like, we know what a school is, we know what education is, we know what all these things are, but what we've been programmed to understand them as is something that is so naturally exclusionary that we have to force ourselves to think differently to have the door open for someone else. You know, and so I really like to have those conversations about decolonization. It's a wide spectrum. But I think it's trying to get as much of the land back into indigenous hands as possible, including indigenous ways of knowing, thinking, being, and speaking in education as much as possible. And then just saying the life and the health of the Tlingit language is a collective responsibility of everybody, and everybody has a role to play. And, you know, and those are difficult things to get some people to buy into, because they think of, you know, America as this monolingual thing. And it's a big part of the story of the United States, is destroying everything that was there to make room for yourself. But there's a consequence to inhumanity. There's a consequence to genocide. And part of that consequence is you raise inhumane human beings. And so I think for me, I just say, well, what if we could say we found a way to not be genocidal, and we found a way to live side by side and to think simultaneously in two different languages, or three or four. And I think that's an exciting prospect.
We'll take a short break. I'm speaking with Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, Emmy-nominated writer for Molly of Denali, language revitalization expert, and poetry writer.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years. With cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from KTOO. Let's continue our rainy day conversation with Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, UAS professor, Emmy-nominated writer for Molly of Denali, language revitalization expert, and poet. How did your language journey begin? Was it something that was in your household as a youth, or is it something, because you've become an expert in the Tlingit language, and people turn to you for a lot of things about it. And I'm just curious, like, how did this journey begin for you?
Yeah, I grew up, I had four grandparents, and two of them could speak their indigenous language. So my father's father could speak Yupik, and my mother's father could speak Tlingit. My mother's mother spoke Haida, but when she went to boarding school and came back, she had lost it. And she would rarely talk about that, but she did talk about this time when she couldn't speak to her own grandmother anymore, who was monolingual in Haida. And then I later learned my father's father failed kindergarten because he refused to speak English. He just wanted to speak Yuchten. And so we grew up with my father's father, but I think my father himself had a complicated relationship with his own Yupik identity because he grew up in Takatna, a lot in Takatna and also McGrath and some of these other areas. But then as he got a little bit older, he's probably 7 or 8 maybe, and his parents had to move to Anchorage, and they had quite a few kids. And so 3 of the kids went into a Catholic boarding school and were horribly abused. I would say think of the worst things that a child can go through, and that's what they went through. And he tried to stand up to them and was violently beaten for trying to protect his siblings and himself from those types of things. But then I went to college, and I was very close with my mother's father. We were always very close. Like, they told me a story one time. I don't even think I was 1. And we all went to Disneyland, and they're eating at a cafe, and they could see, I think his name was Roy Clark. He was a guitar player. He's my grandpa's favorite guitar player. And everyone's saying, go talk to him, go talk to him. My grandpa said, no way, not going to bother him. Too shy. And they turned, and I had ran over to Mr. Roy Clark and as a baby, and then he picked me up and brought me over, and that's how my grandpa met, like, his guitar hero. And so we were always really close. And then as I was sort of going into my teenage years, I didn't get a chance to see him as much as I should have. But when I was in college, he got really sick, and he had a stomach ulcer. And so I came home, and I helped, you know, I think I was in school and stopped and then just came home to help. And then it was his sister, my Auntie Kathy, who said, he's the only one in our family who speaks Tlingit. And so we watched a lot of baseball games. We shared a lot of stories. And one day we're sitting at the kitchen table, and I said, Grandpa, teach me this. Teach me Tlingit. Teach me the language. You know, I was saying Tlingit at the time. And he pointed at the salt shaker, and he said, H. And I tried to say it, and he laughed at me. So goal number one was, like, keep Grandpa from laughing at me. He laughed at everybody. He loved to just laugh and make jokes and stuff. So it wasn't mean-spirited at all. And then he started teaching me things. Then I said, well, I have 1 year of college left. Maybe I'll just stay here and you could teach me Tlingit. And he said, no, go finish. You got 1 year. You finish, then you come back, and then we'll do all the language stuff. So I go back to college. I was at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And towards the end of fall semester, he called me and he said, you should come home. And I said, well, this semester is almost done, then one more, then I'm graduated, I'm done. I think I would have been the first person in my immediate family to have gone to college. And so I kept going, and then he died a couple months later. And I was really hard on myself, and I felt bad for not answering the call, and I felt bad for missing this opportunity. But after I sort of started coming out of grief, I realized, well, I could learn Tlingit. And he and I had this special bond because at the time I was the only one in our family that was learning it. He was the only one in our family that could speak it. And so it had become this sort of thing. And at that time, I was at the University of Minnesota, this language advocate and linguist was driving by the University of Minnesota campus. He had this box of books called Stabilizing Indigenous Languages from a conference that he had helped put together. He had edited this volume. His name is John Reiner. And he said, oh, they got a lot of Native students there. I'll just throw a box of these in their Native Student Center. I went to that center all the time, and I saw this box of books, and I started flipping through it, and I just started reading these articles by Richard Little Bear and Michael Krauss talking about how all Native American languages are extremely endangered. And so I wrote a paper called Stabilizing Indigenous Languages for an upper-level writing class at the University of Minnesota. And when I got that paper back, it said C-, why doesn't everybody speak English? And they didn't write a single comment about how I could make the paper better. So then I thought, then I fought it. So I went to the, it was a TA who graded it. So I went to the teacher, I went to the chair of the English department, I went to the dean of arts and sciences, and I guess it was the dean of the College of Liberal Arts. And I got the grade reversed, but it also lit a fire, and because I realized like there's still people who are against our language for whatever reason, like they think it should be just replaced with English, and like that has not worked out for Indigenous peoples. That has put us through so much harm and so much pain, and so it was a combination of those two things, and then it culminated with just walking around and memorizing as many words as I can at the University of Minnesota. And then coming home and starting to go to these language camps and realizing there were people I could talk to who were my grandpa's age.
I would be remiss if we don't talk a little bit about your poetry book, because you're known for so many things. And then this was published last year, and I was like, wait, he does poetry too? Like, so how did this come about?
Yeah, I guess my journey as a poet probably goes back to my first year of college. Like, I really liked to write stories, and I thought that I'd be a novelist at some point. And then I had this creative writing class, and I wish I could remember the teacher's name. I should, but it was 30 years ago. And I just remember the exercises were so fun, and the process of writing and sharing writing with other people and letting them, in like a real safe environment, having them tell you what they think of it. And I got hooked. And so then I went to the University of Minnesota, and they had a wonderful creative writing program there. And I had a poetry teacher named Diane Glancy, who was herself a successful Indigenous poet. And she was she had very high expectations. And I just remember I wrote probably 20 poems in that class. And I really fell in love with poetry. And they were reading a lot of poets from all around. And then I went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I was going to either go into linguistics or creative writing. And so I went to the Alaska Native Language Center, and nobody was there at that time. It was just a timing thing. And then I went to the English department, and they said, oh, yeah, we'll set up a meeting with this guy. And his name was Derek Burleson. And I just had this conversation with him for about half an hour, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go get an MFA. And I got to hang out with him a lot. We got to hang out with a lot of visiting poets. And then one of my favorite poets was Nora Dauenhauer. And I would remember listening to her read poetry and thinking, well, what I read on the page, I never would have thought it would sound like that, you know? And so I just remember how much she loved going places and reading poetry. And she'd just be bumping elbows with Joy Harjo and other, like, these people who were just such heroes of mine. And so Peggy Schumacher was a wonderful advocate of creative writing. And she had reached out to help me finish a novel project I was working on. And then she reached out and said, started talking to me about a book of poetry. And then I have a friend, and he was working on his book of poetry as well. And he and I used to hang out a lot at UAF. And as he was working on his book of poetry, he said, I want you to put together a manuscript and to show it to the University of Alaska Press. And so it was so wonderful, because I remember I was in an artist residency outside of San Francisco, and I had all these poems on the wall, and I was thinking, if I were to ever write a book, I wonder what order they would go in. And I started to envision these four sets, and like based on this metaphor of Kakan, the sun, and you say Kakan Khus is a sunbeam, Kakan Khus Yi is when the sun kind of breaks through the clouds out on the horizon. It means below the foot of the sun, and Kakan Khus means foot of the sun. And if there's a patch of sunlight like a cat likes to lay in all the time, Kakan Khus Iti, the remnants of the foot of the sun. And like how there are so many metaphors just tied into that sort of thing. And so that became the driving structure of the poem. And then it includes poems I've written, some of them shortly before the book was published, while I was going through the process, and some of them I had written in, I think, 1997, some of the oldest poems in there.
And why did you decide to publish this in 2024?
Well, I have always wanted to have a book of poetry, you know? Like, so just talking to poets and talking about how did you write a book? Like, how'd you do a whole book, you know? And so at both the University of Minnesota and the University of Fairbanks would have visiting writers, which for a creative writing program, I think is the best thing, because then you could talk to folks about how did you do it? And we got to visit with some pretty prominent authors, and they talked about their process and how they stuck with it and how I didn't have to feel bad that it took me 30 years to do a book of poetry. Like, it's fine, you know? And so, but some of them, I read one in Skagway, and it was about my grandma, and then I made my auntie and my wife cry. And I think about that too, because my poetry sometimes, a lot of it is a release of the sorrow of life a lot of times. And so sometimes there's a couple in there that are maybe like funny joke poems, but a lot of them are pretty heavy, just as I dealt with. I went through a period in about 5 years where I lost my grandmother and my father and my stepmother and my mother, who were sisters, and my little brother. And it was just going through so much incredible grief at that time that putting words on a page were something that really helped me through it.
Wow. Well, it's an awesome collection. I'm wondering if we might ask you, would you read one or two?
Yeah. Uski a kasechja kayana Catherine Twitchell. Ach uski a khatletsini at ilkudzi. Ach yedi. Iko ayach kwan. Iko ayach kwan. One kanins gashetzi choe yashingetani. Kwashe Tesuk a ah yachka hut, you sing it, Annie. Tessa aye away just to cut it. Ha, Annie. Hakusi. Ha, you a tongue. A quiet to yeety. Ha, to tunny. Kagach to arch, to kagach to arch. Has to tend the tiny hagus a tea. Ha, tug a quinkian. Hast du tuulet si nechiseti? Ach yedi, ishikuzi, chasatini at, ach uski a. Yeah, I remember writing this. I was in a poetry workshop, I think. Maybe we were just hanging out as poets, and we were going to have our first child. And I thought a lot about the state of our language and what's going on.
Mm.
And then I wrote it, and I remember I read the translation, and one of my friends was like, that's a lot of pressure to put on a kid. And I was like, well, it's not pressure. It's more like I think things are going to shift with every coming generation. Mm-hmm. And they're going to shift towards strength.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and if you buy the book, you can get the English translation later in the pages. That's something that you say at the bottom. There's a little footnote on each of the ones that are in Thinkit, and it says, hey, if you want the English version, go to page 100.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
You know, through the writing process, something really unfortunate happened was people review your book, and then so they commit to, like, publishing it, and then they have folks who read it, and then they give you ideas on how you could sort of tighten things up. Mm. And that's a good idea. It's a good process. But somebody who read this collection of poetry saw some of the poems that didn't have translations or that were written all in Tlingit, and they gave it a really awful review. They said they actually thought it shouldn't be published and it wasn't ready. And then they had some sort of line in there that was, they felt that writing poems in an indigenous language and not translating them felt like 1970s politics to them. And I remember it was like a very racist sort of review of my book. And luckily the folks at the University of Alaska Press were very responsive and very, they felt bad. But I remember I wrote to them, I said, why would you ever send this to me? Like, why? And so, but they found someone else to review it. But I did put a couple of, there's a couple of things in the intro, I think, that are aimed at that particular reviewer. So I didn't have nice things to say about them.
Next, could we read that one?
Yeah. More? So I'll pick this one. You pick the first one. There is a speaker named Chukatine, and we're working with one of her stories right now. And, I'll give a little bit of backstory on this one, and the translation for the other one is in the book. It's about my kid. But for this one, she was on her deathbed, and me and a friend were sent, my friend was there in Whitehorse with her, and I was here in Juneau. And he would record videos of her, and then he would text them to me. And then I'd record videos of myself and text them to him. And we'd speak Tlingit to each other, and that's how I helped her. And this is one of the last things that she said. Ha-ch-as. Chukateen is leaving this world. Her lungs are filling with water, they say. Not long ago, she shared with us, Ach-ish yi hayam sakayan. Ayik wudishqat yak tak dekas de nakuch. We send videos to each other through the hands of Shku Yil. He makes sure she exits through dialogue, as do all who cup her words, the river rolling of our language. My father used to tell us, a boat full of silence drifts quickly towards the waterfall. It's crushing, the deafening loss. We give up without a battle cry. Chu'uwayak ika huin he de yeshunai at. These were her last words, which I cannot translate because you must run to them.
I remember reading that, and it took my breath away at the end.
Yeah, the first line, like, we were just recording videos, and then she just said it. And I remember listening to her, and I was like, this is a big metaphor. I got to ask her about it. A boat full of silence. Yes, and she said, this is what my father used to always say. Mm. And then the other line that's not translated in there might have been the last words that she said. And it's a beautiful sentiment. If you are learning the Tlingit language, if you're teaching it, then that line is aimed at you. And it's incredible to have an elder. When I first met her, we were speaking, we were there for some business because, like, someone from her husband's clan was unfortunately dying. And while she was dying, she would only speak Tlingit, so I'd gone to talk to her. And then they went to go take care of clan business, talk about the funeral and everything else. And so I went there, and that's not my clan, it's my grandfather's clan. And they go into another room, and I'm sitting across with this elder I hadn't met before. And she said, what brings you here? And I said, oh, I'm teaching Tlingit. And she said, do you speak Tlingit? And I said, yeah. And then she started speaking to me in Tlingit. And you know, those moments are so, it's exhilarating because here's someone I've never met and they're speaking Tlingit. And they're obviously, it doesn't take me long to figure out they're very good. They're a really good speaker. And we talked for about 15 minutes about migrations and where she lived and where I've lived and what we're doing and what she's been doing. And then they come out and they're done with their business. And she looks at me and she says, I haven't spoken Tlingit like that since my dad died. And I thought, whoa. You know, and it was just such an amazing moment. And just like we were connected from that moment on. And every time I saw her, I would speak Tlingit. And I guess I'll close on this was sometimes I get so sad that we're losing our speakers. And then we're doing this workshop in Whitehorse. And it was lunchtime. And all the elders who could speak the language, they all just grabbed their food first, and they all sat at one table together. And my middle daughter, Yayakinachich, she goes to get her lunch, and she's probably 5 years old, maybe. And she just goes and sits with those elders. And I was watching, and I was at a table kind of far away, and I was planning the afternoon activities. And at one point, I looked over, and I saw them all laughing, and I thought, they're speaking Tlingit to her, and she knows what they're saying. And it was such a moment of incredible joy that it just lifts all that weight, it lifts all that pain, and it's just like comes back to laughter and intergenerational connections.
Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, UAS professor, author, screenwriter, and now Emmy-nominated writer, poet, everything, language revitalization expert, like all of it. Thank you so much, Gunath Cheesh, for coming in and sharing with us today during our rainy day conversation. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
Cheese.
This has been Rainy Day Conversations on Juno Afternoon from KTOO 104.3 and KAUK 91.7 in Juneau, Alaska. Catch the extended version of our chat as a podcast by subscribing to Juno Afternoon in your favorite podcast app or visiting the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program. Gunath Cheesh for sharing in conversation with us. Thank you.